Hello and welcome to Ask the Mayor on WBAA. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. We're glad you're with us. My guest this week speaking to us by phone from his office is Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton, and we'd love your questions for him during the next half an hour. You can always call those in to area code 765-496-1999. You can send an email to ask@wbaa.org, and you can tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Mr. Mayor, good afternoon. Nice to talk to you again.
Good afternoon. Good to be here.
Let me start with kind of a broad question that asks you to look forward a little bit into the coming year. Give me an issue, if you would, that's on your radar for 2017 that maybe was not something that you were thinking about as you came into this year, either something that you think you're going to have to spend more time on or something that you see as a goal for the coming 12 months. Is there something like that that you've been thinking about lately?
Well, economic development, I think, is front and center for me next year, and I suppose that's a recurring theme, but we go through cycles where I think, you know, we're on the right path, and then I think there's times we have to step back and rethink things a little bit, and I'm kind of in that position right now that we're going to be rethinking economic development and how we approach some things in the coming year and probably have some action there and some announcements even in January.
What specific tenets of economic development are you hoping to readdress?
Well, I think our approach largely and really making sure that we as elected officials are doing our part. It becomes pretty easy to hide in this this jungle of all these organizations and say, well, you know, this didn't get done because they didn't do it or so on. I want to make sure that as elected officials we're really stepping up and doing our part. But one place that I think we've sorely lacked in our community and still continue to do so is on the retail side. We really focus on the jobs piece, and we're spending a lot of time focusing on quality of life in general, but we don't spend any time at all focusing on making sure we bring the right retail opportunities to this community, dining and you know, shopping and things like that. So we're going to kind of really start to focus in on some of those things as well.
Are you talking more about big box stores? I mean, we've talked a lot about your discussions with Walmart on this program. Or are you talking more about trying to fill like your downtown spaces with mom and pop style businesses?
Well, I think it runs the gamut. I think you need a mix of both. And, you know, our downtown has a very low vacancy rate right now. Our downtown is pretty full and it's pretty tight. So we've done a nice job there. But I think, you know, people want a variety of things, and, you know, they largely assume that local government is responsible for that. I you know, hear that we need this or we need that, or why did you bring another pizza place to our community? And we largely have not had anything to do with that. So I think if the public expects us to be at least making some effort there, we probably ought to be putting some resources into doing so.
Are there some things that you as a city can do to encourage people to start their own businesses that you perhaps have not been doing in recent years?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and that's a big part of the Fusion 54 project is to make sure we are really nurturing entrepreneurs and giving them the opportunity to succeed in our community. And that's a, you know, that's a new field. We're having to think differently there than we've thought in the past. So that is evolving, and I expect to see some changes in that area.
As we look forward into 2017, of course, the legislative session is almost upon us now. What do you need? What does your city need from the legislature when it convenes in a couple of weeks? Is there anything specific that you're planning to make some sort of ask on?
I don't have anything specific right now. Again, it goes back to the basics of looking at infrastructure funding, looking at road funding, and really trusting local government to respond to their community and really fulfill their role without a tremendous amount of meddling or regulation from the state level. That's what I always look for, and that's what I try to impart on my elected officials at the State House.
Have you had any recent conversations with Tim Brown, your representative, who's the head of the House Ways and Means Committee and has been for a few sessions now, about something that he could do for the community? Do you get the sense that he tries to find carve-outs for Crawfordsville in any way?
Well, I don't get that sense, no. You know, and I mean, and we have those discussions. We talk about things that are important to our community, and I think Representative Brown is very aware that he doesn't want to create an image that he's favoring Crawfordsville over somebody else. I think he really tries to look at the big picture and make decisions objectively on really what's good for the entire state. That being said, he does live here. He does understand our community, and I make every effort to you know, ensure that he understands the things that are important to our community when it comes to transportation and some of those issues.
And with respect to transportation, of course, one thing you and I have talked a lot about, and we've seen actually a little bit of a maturation of Representative Brown's feelings on, is the Hoosier State train. Have you had a conversation with him about whether that is going to get a dedicated line item in the next two-year state budget?
We've discussed it. He knows, you know, how I feel. He knows how important it is to our community. I believe he's taken the opportunity to do his own homework, and you know, certainly no promises there that we'll see that, but he's certainly listening to what we're saying about it.
And do you get the sense that your constituents are trying to get a hold of him as well?
I'm not sure. I mean, I know some are, and I know some are, you know, trying to get that message across that mass transit and rail transportation is important. And it's important all over the state. So, you know, I'm sure they have to prioritize, but we've proven with the Hoosier State that this concept will work, this model will work. We just need to keep pushing forward and moving forward with it.
I just want to get back to infrastructure in a second, but let me ask you a couple more questions about the train. There was an editorial by the editor of the Lafayette newspaper here a few days ago saying he'd taken a ride on the Hoosier State, just and one ride. He said that it involved some delays. There was a bus ride that came back from Chicago. The bus broke down, so we obviously had a bad
right.
day. And he said it left him sort of unconvinced that Iowa Pacific was the right partner to be running this train. Is that fair, do you think?
Well, I think it was, I mean, it was obviously a fair assessment of that particular day. I think if you look at the overall data, on-time performance is up, profits are up, ridership is up, all those things are improving. It by no means is where it needs to be. That I think we'll all agree on that. I did look at that piece, and unfortunately, I mean, I do follow what's going on with the train on a almost daily basis, and was aware that we had had some problems there for two or three days, and he just happened to hit right in the worst of the worst of situations. So, you know, for the most part, it's running on time, and it's fairly consistent and fairly reliable. We just have to continue to push and improve reliability and on-time performance. And to be fair, some of that is outside the control of Iowa Pacific. Some of that lies with the host railroads and their ability to make sure that we have a top priority to get through.
Do you think the state needs a new partner, or are you content to keep going with Ed Ellis and his team at Iowa Pacific?
Well, I think we should evaluate it as we move forward, and as we come to a close with that contract, I think we certainly should look at every option that's out there, and if somebody, you know, if we think there's a better option on the table, then we probably should consider it, but I think we've made significant strides, and I think that team has made significant strides.
There's been a lot of talk about improvements in ridership, improvements in revenue, trying to make on-time performance better, and it has gotten better in fits and starts over the last year or so. If there is a line item, and I've talked to NDOT folks who say they're going to ask for one in the coming budget, what does Iowa Pacific, do you think, need to show as a measure of improvement for its next budget cycle? Is it the same sorts of things, or is it adding new amenities, adding more trains? Does the bar go up for them if they get more funding from the state and indeed from communities like yours that have been paying in for years now?
Well, I think they need to show that the reliability is continuing to improve, and it's far better than it was. But, you know, when you look at the actual rolling stock, I think it's solid. Locomotives, maybe we could come up a level or something there to really improve reliability. But, you know, what we're looking for is that we can get it to the point that we can start to expand and speed up the process, and that's really outside their control. But is the state going to invest in a partnership with these host railroads to upgrade these lines so that they're rated higher than, you know, I'm not sure what they are. Some of those are 50 or 55 miles per hour probably, which really slows down the process when you're comparing that to interstates at, you know, a much higher speed.
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA. We're talking today with Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton. Please send your questions to us via email. That address is ask, that's A-S-K, at WBAA.org. Tweet questions at WBAA News on Twitter or call them in live. 765-496-1999 is our telephone number. One last question on this before we move on to talking about other infrastructure things. We have heard people say, including Representative Brown, that there may not be time for discussion in what has been billed as an infrastructure session of the legislature to talk about anything but roads and bridges, in some part because the recent estimates say the state's going to need $1 billion of extra spending per year for the next two decades just to keep up with roads and bridges. With that on the table, there may not be time for talk about rail and other infrastructure. Do you worry about the Hoosier State getting lost in the shuffle of all of the road and bridge talk?
I don't think it'll get lost in the shuffle. I think there's enough drive out there. There's enough interest, and certainly a lesson learned from a few years ago when basically NDOT and the legislature was just going to take this off the table. It wasn't even going to be discussed. And I think they heard loud and clear from all the communities along the route and from a lot of interested parties that this was very important. And I have no doubt that they would hear even more loudly this time because we've proven that we can be successful. So I don't think it'll get lost in the shuffle. I'm sure there's a lot of things going on, but this will be part of the equation.
With respect to those roads and bridges, you and I have talked a fair amount on this program about the reconstruction of 231 and other downtown roads that you've had. Are there specific projects that you've been waiting on, either big ticket items or complicated items that you're hoping that you might find some new funding for if the state passes a bill that gives lots of extra road funding?
Well, we always have a priority list within our own community that depends on funding coming back to us from the state. So we certainly have a list there, and we're going to make some real progress on that in the coming year, through some of the money that the legislature has released. So we're pretty excited about what will happen this next construction season. And then as far as bigger projects that the state might be involved in, certainly of importance to the city, and there'll be some eyes roll when I say this, but the grade separation for three state highways coming through our community and crossing a major rail line, that has continued to be a problem that's plagued our community, and I think the our legislators are finally taking that issue seriously. For far too many years, when you would bring that up, they would deny that the state had any role in that, and laugh and chuckle and pass it off as a joke, and it's quite frankly not a joke. Public safety is at risk. It divides our community. Three state highways are backing up. They're the state's highways, and it's creating a major problem in our community. So they are taking that seriously now, and when we bring it up, they do engage in conversation. So we certainly would put that at the top of the list. And then, that 231 issue between Crawfordsville and Lafayette needs to be addressed at some point. That's something that'll take many years to play out, but that's certainly on the list as well.
On other infrastructure notes, we've talked a little on this program about the city raising wastewater rates to cover some of your combined sewer overflow project costs. And there was news recently the city can actually expect some savings on those original cost estimates. Can you tell me how that's going to work?
Well, we're entering into a guaranteed savings contract with an engineering firm that will actually oversee the construction process. And while this is a new process to us and Crawfordsville City Government, other communities have followed this process, and certainly school corporations have followed this. And so we give them the model, and they look for ways to engineer this in a way to reduce those costs and work with the contractors who will actually carry this out to reduce those costs. So you kind of shift responsibility there and put it on them instead of having a general contractor who's paid a lump sum plus change orders and those kinds of things. So we know it's a model that's worked very well for other communities, and we're going to follow that. And it's really two parts to that project. Combined sewer is one piece, but the larger piece is actually within the wastewater plant itself, some significant upgrades there. And as I always remind everybody, these are absolutely necessary for us to achieve compliance with the EPA and the Indiana Department of Environmental Management.
You referred to it as a guaranteed savings program, and that is how they're referred to. But what actually is the guarantee there? How do you guarantee that you're going to get some cash back either at the front end because it's going to cost less than you originally thought, or at the back end because it'll have been done faster or at less cost or something like that?
Right. Built into that contract is figures that actually show what they're guaranteeing we're going to save. And in this case, it's around $2 million that we can shave off of this project. And that's just built in. They have to perform at that level. And if they don't, then that responsibility starts to shift back to them. So, again, it's a model that was new to us, and it took us a while to kind of work our way through it, but has been very successful in other communities.
One of the things that got talked about around here when the State Street project was being bid out in West Lafayette was that you had a couple, three major contractors who were working with a $120 million budget for State Street. And one of the questions that came up but never really got successfully answered, I don't think, was, well, when you've got this competition, shouldn't competition build a better product at a lower price? I mean, that's the strict economic definition of what competition does. And so it would seem like if you've got a stated amount of money, you could have the companies go back and forth and say, I can do X, Y, and Z. And then the other company says, I can do X, Y, and Z plus one. Do you find that sort of public-private partnership model might be something that you're going to try to use more in that competitive way going forward to try to come up with savings like this?
I think so. We're going to see how this goes with this particular project. We employed a similar concept with the building of a new fire station on the east side of our city. We're always looking for these new innovative ways to help control costs and really hold people accountable. You know, next year we'll go to bid on Fusion 54, and that's a fairly decent-sized project in which we will probably employ what we call construction management in that process as well. So it's all about making it as competitive as possible to get the best product we can for the money we spend.
Well, since you brought up a stellar project there, let me ask you about another one that's gotten on the drawing board. The design for the Pocket Park has been released. I had a couple of questions I wanted to ask you about that. There are no bathrooms in it. This is something that people have mentioned because I guess they would have chewed up a significant portion of the budget. Is that correct?
Yeah, we estimated the bathroom or restrooms themselves would eat up about 40% of the budget. So really what we tried to do with this park is number one, to stay on budget, but number two, to really build the infrastructure that we can add to as time goes by. And so the plumbing, everything for restrooms down the way will be in place, and we won't have to tear anything up when we come back. And if a few years from now we say, hey, we can afford that, let's add those, we can build those in at that time. So we've really tried to create what I think will be a nice park, a nice gathering place with most of the amenities people wanted, but also build the infrastructure so that we can continue to build on it and add to it as time passes by.
Do you worry, though, that the lack of restrooms will decrease the amount that the park gets used?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. We have a great relationship with the public library, which is located adjacent to that site right now. When we have events, they open their facility and their restrooms. And we're working on some other potential solutions. There's some other property in the area that could really lend itself to solving this problem. So it's certainly something that's not dead and over with. It's not something that's been fully decided. We have several options out there.
You mentioned you wanted to add more amenities as time goes on. What are you hoping for if you had a magic wand?
Well, if you look at we rolled out like the original design, which was about $1.5 million, and our budget's $500,000. So there's another $1 million worth of things there. But there was more seating, built-in type seating. There was a better sound system. The stage could be covered. Obviously, the restrooms on site, storage facility that kind of blends in. You don't really notice it on site. Some gates at the end of Pike Street, so you can kind of close that off and have a better look to it as you close that off instead of just putting a barricade across there. So there were a lot of those kind of things that we think we can add as time goes on. And one thing we're going to be doing is we're looking at a program that's very similar to crowdfunding, only it's called crowd granting. And the state is operating this program, and so they will match up to $50,000. So if we are able to get people in the community to raise you know, 50,000, let's say, they will give us another 50, and we could tackle $100,000 worth of work in addition to what we're already planning. But so we're planning that, and then another piece is that we're working really hard on some corporate sponsors, and I'm confident we're going to get some money there as well that could offset some of those extras that we want to add. But we want to keep expectations real, so we didn't want to show people, you know, this is what it's going to look like, and then it comes in at a lesser level. We want to show them the basics, and then hopefully as we gain more money, we can add to it from there.
We've got about 10 minutes left with Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton today on Ask the Mayor here on WBAA. Call in your questions. 765-496-1999 is the telephone number. Email questions to ask@WBAA.org or tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter. Well, since we have last talked, your rental ordinance that we've mentioned in this program has passed the City Council, and I wanted to ask you about the language in it. It says, and I want to see if my understanding of this is correct, it may very well be way off. It says rental owners are going to pay that $5 registration fee that you and I have talked about just once for, and now I'm going to start quoting, it says, quote, one or more parcels of contiguous real property upon which are located one or more structures containing rental units if, A, the combined total of all rental units in all of the structures is five or more. Now, here's where I'm going to show that I'm not a math major, but does this mean that if I buy four houses that are next to each other and rent them each as a single unit, I have to pay $20 a year, but if I buy an entire block of houses, I only have to pay $5 a year?
If they're all on the same parcel, and that's going to be the key, is whether or not they get them on the same parcel. So what we're really saying is these complexes that have, I don't know, make it, you know, whatever it is, 50 units are not going to be taxed on, you know, all those units or charge that fee on those units. But, you know, somebody, we're going to look at this on a parcel-by-parcel basis. So typically, you know, you're going to have a house on one parcel. It's very unlikely that you're going to see somebody come back and parcel these together because they might want to sell one piece off down the road. That's kind of cost prohibitive. So that's the way it's set up, you know, and that's the approach we'll take with that.
So you were aiming less at single family houses than you were at large complexes of apartments.
Well, we didn't want to create a huge burden on those large complexes to say I have 50 units times five. I mean, that's certainly a much different figure than somebody who has two houses they rent out, let's say. So we carved it out in the parcel way, and it's a model that we adopted from other communities. I mean, it's not something that we came up with on our own. That's what seems to work very well in other communities, and the concept made sense to us.
We talked last month about the apparent homestead deduction fraud that your county and probably every other county in Indiana are seeing, and that this was part of your design in doing this. Do you hope to take the list of people that you're making who may not be completely in compliance with the homestead law and cross-reference that in some way with the registration list that's eventually going to be developed? Because it would seem like that would give you some sort of proof that some of these people are, in fact, renting properties, but nonetheless Absolutely. Then claiming deductions to which they're not entitled.
Absolutely. That is front and center. One of the first things we will be doing, you know, along with the inspections, is making sure, you know, when people register these as a rental, they're verifying in writing that they're in compliance with the homestead laws in Indiana, and we will cross-reference that with the county's data to make sure that there aren't any issues there. Again, you know, we had people come and testify in the council meeting who said, you know, this is a terrible thing, we shouldn't do this. It was interesting, if you just started to look most of these people up, they had multiple homestead exemptions. So, you know, we know we're going to run into it. We absolutely know that. And we have somebody working right now to cross-reference publicly available data to look at this issue. And, for example, voter registration lists do not match the homestead information. So we're working on collecting that data, and we will be turning that over to the county here in the coming weeks to say, here's a list of things that we think are a problem. We want you to address these.
And you mentioned that ordinance makes people sign in writing that they're trying to comply with the homestead law. But you have to do the same thing to actually get that deduction in the first place. And the problem with the law is it also says that you, as the homeowner, if you move out of that home, have to be the one who then goes back to the county and says, I no longer, and thus the property no longer, should have a homestead deduction in my name. And that is a large reason why a lot of these things get missed, is because the onus is not on the county or the municipality, it's on the homeowner. So does your solution actually solve the problem? I mean, you're asking the same thing that the state law says.
Well, I don't know that it's going to totally solve it, but it'll go a long way. But I don't know that I necessarily agree that's why we have this problem, because, you know, when a property transfers, they strip everything off of there. That's done automatically through the courthouse. I mean, that happens. You know, if you refinance, they actually strip everything off there and you start over. So I know that it gets stripped off there. The problem is the new owner coming in and falsely signing in many cases, this document saying that this is where they live and that this is eligible for homestead tax deduction, when it's quite simply not.
Right, when they don't live there. They don't live there. Right, and they're renting it out instead.
Yes, absolutely.
The ordinance, as it finally got passed, I think you have to say is fairly lenient. I mean, the fee is minuscule. The city is has to give 3 days' notice to inspect anything they might think might be a derelict property, and that would seem to be more than enough time to clean up most messes that would cause people to have problems.
We hope so.
Did it have to be this easy on the landlords to get it passed?
Well, I think we wanted to make sure we put enough assurances in there that we're not out to go after those people who are doing the right thing. And we understand that you can own property and the renter might be the problem sometimes. We understand that. And so this is not a witch hunt out there going after those people who are trying to do the right thing. But, you know, to say that we need to give 3 days' notice before we go inspect, that's far better than what we have under the existing state statutes, for sure. So this is a big leap forward for us, and really allows us to start getting our arms around this very complex problem. We're going to meet next week internally to really lay out our plan of attack and how we move forward with this over the next few months and implement this and get it started. But I think it's going to be very good for our community, and it will take a while. This will not change things overnight, but it's a very good start, and I'm very reassured by the people I talk to on the street who say, thank you so much. We, you know, our neighborhood has a problem with this, and we really appreciate you trying to tackle this issue.
Wanted to get to a quick question that's come in from one of our callers who wants to know whether the courthouse tower is being replaced. I know that's county property, but I figure you may have some insight into what's going on there.
Right. That's county property, but it's also the fundraising is being done by a private group who's been working on that for many years. And they actually, and I think I know the answer here, but they did put this out to bid a few weeks ago, the county, and I think they expect those bids back pretty soon. And when those bids come back, then they will know, instead of the guesswork of we think it's going to cost X amount, they will know exactly what it will cost. So I know there's been some move by the county to contribute some money to this, we'll know here pretty soon what that exact dollar figure is and how we move forward. But we're certainly supportive of that project because it will have a very large impact on our downtown. So as I tell everyone, it will get done. We just have to be patient and let it play out. But it certainly will happen.
All right. Well, Mr. Mayor, we have unfortunately run out of time on this week's program. But the good news is I've got some things to ask you in January when we reconvene again. So allow me to just take a second to say thanks for all the time you've given us in 2016. Happy holidays to you and your family. And we look forward to doing this again next year.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it as well.
All right. This has been Ask the Mayor on WBAA. Remember that you can find all of these programs archived at our website. That's WBAA.org, and you can send questions for any of our four mayors to ask@WBAA.org. We've got a fifth Thursday of the month coming up next week. That means no show next week, so we'll be back in 2 weeks for our first show of 2017 with West Lafayette's John Dennis. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Happy holidays, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Support for WBAA comes from your membership and Encompass Credit Union, supporting Ask the Mayor and offering a full line of financial services to the people of Clinton and Tipton counties while supporting the communities they serve. More information at EncompassCU.org.